Well, good morning. It's good to be with you all today. Before I start into the message, I want to kind of bring you up to date on Sue's situation. Where is Sue's situation? Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. She thinks she can just do whatever she wants when she's at church. And she can. So she's had two surgeries, one in November and one in December. And the one in December was actually two surgeries, and she was in surgery for 4 hours, and it was major stuff. But the intent was to get some lymph nodes and then to take out more tissue in the bad area. And so then they did that, and then they had to biopsy these areas, you see. So, and they did that, and we found out Friday that those biopsies were clear. So that's a good thing. So we're so grateful for that. She will undergo radiation because you might have a clear biopsy, but you also might still have some floating cancer cells, and they want to eliminate those. So she'll have radiation in about 6 weeks. She has to heal up so that they can have at her again. That's what they had. She had to heal up so she could have another surgery. And then she has to take some kind of hammer drug for 5 years that will hopefully keep it from, what? It'll make her crabby. They said that. And I'm not even going there. No, I'm not even touching that. So, but we're so grateful. Just last night, she and I had dinner with my best friend from childhood. And he's remained a great friend all these years. And this dinner was because he is remarrying a woman who met him in a prayer effort for him when he lost his wife to cancer, to liver cancer, a year and a half ago. She lost her husband to liver cancer. And she was from Bourbonnais. He's from Chatham. And just through this prayer relationship, she fell in love with him, and to hear their story was something. But I was sitting there last night with my wife, who is a cancer patient, and my friend Bruce and his future wife, Bobby. I'm marrying them on the 29th, and that's a great privilege. But I sat there, and it kind of overwhelmed me that these two have lost. And we loved Peggy, Bruce's wife. She was phenomenal. They've lost their spouses to this, and it just humbled me, and I thank God that she had that good report. So keep praying for us. I was more emotional about it, I think, than Sue was, but she's a trooper. She's so tough, and I'm grateful for her, and she helps me through these kind of things. So thank you very much for your prayers and all of that. Matthew's family, that was a moment I'll never forget. Thank you for doing that. Turn to Matthew 2, please. This is what we're going to do. I'm going to read this and make some comments about it, but then we have four slides we're going to look at. Okay? I've been asking this question, so I'll ask you. I come up with questions that have absolutely no lasting value, and you can, it means nothing, but it's just discussion. So here's my question to you. How much do you think the baby Jesus weighed when he was born? 8'4"? Big guy. All right.
7 pounds, 7 ounces.
Because of perfect numbers. All right. Can I say something, Dave? I don't think they used pounds and ounces back then. But that was prophetic. All right. Any other reasons for another number?
7'3". 7'3",
okay. Oh, yeah, okay. Now, here's my thought, and since I'm the pastor, I get to say this. People were small. People were small back then. I would have been in a circus back then. Seriously. Seriously. I could be now, probably. Huh? People were small, and I can only imagine that a young teenage mother was small. I would imagine, this is just, nobody knows. Ask him when we see him. But I would imagine that he was between 5 and 6. I'm just saying. I think that's, it's got to be small enough that this young girl can have him and not have it ruin her. And I think Chris said something about, he was always, everything about him was humble. So there's just something kind of humbling about being small. So who knows? It's just worth thinking. But in our story today, there's something we need to recognize. That the creches we see, or the artwork we see, and we're going to see some. And you have some on, you have Rembrandt on the cover of your program, and you know how I love Rembrandt. We're going to see one, a different one, later. But if you see any kind of Christmas effort that has the shepherds and the wise men and baby Jesus all at the place together, that's not what the Bible teaches us. And you'll see that. The wise men came a little later. It can be anywhere from right after he was born, a few days, to 2 years. So this period of time can be a little bit of an unknown thing. Let's read this. Matthew 2, verse 1. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, let's stop. Scott shared the passage from Micah, which lifts up Bethlehem, this least of all towns, but which is the city of David. It lifts it up as the birthplace of the one who would come and shepherd Israel. Now, there are more than 300 prophecies in the Old Testament about the life of Jesus. And they're very compelling. They should build our faith. But if there's anything that a human being cannot control, it's where he is or she is born. You'd really have no say in that. Jesus was from Nazareth, way to the north. But he was born in the city of David, and that was the prophecy. And if we want to connect dots, we connect the dots of both of his parents are from the same lineage that David's from. So that was determined before the foundation of the world, but all these generations in the interim, and they end up in Nazareth. So interesting there. So Bethlehem is established. In the days of Herod the king. Now I tell you, the Jewish recipients of Matthew's gospel would have identified with this description of Herod the king, because he was the king under whom the temple, now when you see pictures of Jerusalem, you see the walls of the temple. The temple's gone. The temple was destroyed by Titus in AD 70, but that was Herod's temple. And so when you see people praying, you see people there, it's called Herod's temple. And Herod was not a good guy. There's so much evidence of that, and we'll hear some here in a minute. Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? Now, this is what I learned this week, and so I'm going to share that with you. These wise men, magi, which is plural of magos, M-A-G-O-S, which is the singular, in this day, these individuals would have been a real interesting mix of life purposes. In ancient days, and we're going to see in ancient before this, we're going to see an example of a magi before these guys by thousands of years. And we'll get to that. But by this time, they've become a broader job description. Originally, they were seers, S-E-E-R, prophets. They were in their Eastern pagan world, and we say Eastern, we're talking about either Persia, modern-day Iran, or Babylon, modern-day Iraq. Interesting how the news of our day is so filled every night with Iraq and Iran. Well, these individuals would have come from there. And by this time, they're more than just seers. They're magicians, possibly. They are prophets. And that becomes very important in this story. They are people who study the stars. And they would have also been religious experts. All religions that they could learn about. So these were learned men. Okay, so that's who has come. And they come with this question, where is he who's been born king of the Jews? How did they know to do that? Well, obviously God is sovereign over this whole situation, but how does it appear it happened? There were Jews still living in Babylon. There were Jews in communities in Persia. And they would have had these prophecies about the king of the Jews, and they would have looked for Messiah and shared those prophecies. Okay, I want you to hold your finger there, but we're going to turn to a book we rarely read, and that's the book of Numbers. Turn to Numbers 24. This was so exciting to me. Probably heard it before, forgotten it. But Numbers 24. We meet here an ancient magi. Magos, I should say. It's one guy. His name is Balaam. Raise your hand if you're familiar with Balaam. All right, good. This isn't the only thing about him. It's interesting. He comes to Israel as a destroyer of Israel, but God, through the use of a donkey and other means, actually turns him, and what he initially does is a blessing to Israel. He pronounces blessing instead of cursing. But later on, his true colors come out, and he becomes a problem. At this point, however, he is just spouting the words of God, and he's not a believer in Jehovah God. But in this oracle, or this statement of his prophecy, he is going to tell us some things. See if any of this connects with our understanding of the birth of Jesus. So, Numbers 24... Verse 17, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab to the east of Israel, and break down all the sons of Sheth. Edom will be dispossessed. Seir also, his enemies shall be dispossessed. Israel is doing valiantly, and one from Jacob shall exercise dominion and destroy the survivors of cities. Now I tell you, friends, I could read that in a study of Numbers and not make any connection. But thankfully, some Bible scholars have made this connection, that Balaam was a sort of predecessor to the Magi, because he pronounces here the prophecy of God that a star is going to lead to the one who has dominion. And that star is what these wise men were looking for. They would have had understanding of this prophecy. Now, it's thought that they probably traveled on foot or camel or in caravan. That was the only way to go. at least 800 miles. And let's say that they made 15 to 20 miles a day. We don't really know, but let's say that. It probably took them 50 days, 40 days. Depends on the travel and the weather and all that. But it was a long trip, started by the fact that they saw in the sky the star of the King of the Jews. Now, this has been interesting. There's a new book out, and people are touting it. It's a book about what a Christian astrologer has looked back and found was a confluence of things back then and could well be the star. Except I have a problem with this. It's going to tell us soon that the star, once they got to Jerusalem and they talked to Herod, then the star reappeared and showed them where the baby was. Now, it's possible that the star in the sky from Jerusalem could show them right over this house in Bethlehem. But I tend to think that this was a special God-shaped, designed, and put in place star, evidence of Jesus. We'll find that out in the next life. But they came with an understanding that the King of the Jews had been born because of this and probably other prophecies about him. They say this, "For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled." And an interesting line here, "and all Jerusalem with him." The word was out. Hey, these guys are here, and they believe the King of the Jews has been born, and everybody's like, whoa, Messiah, you know, been born, da-da-da. So it's got people fussed up. Just a quick thought. Interesting that Jesus is not born in Jerusalem and that he's not raised in Jerusalem, because Jerusalem was the center of things and becoming that again. I think that we can just say that having him be born in such a humble estate and then growing up in the north, can anything good come out of there, that's said, is another example of his humility. And he was even rejected by the people of his own town. But Jerusalem was not yet to be the center of his life. "And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, 'In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, O you, O Bethlehem, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.'" That's a passage from Micah. "Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, 'Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him.' After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was." That's what I'm talking about. It moved and it came to rest over that house. "When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy, and going into the house," and this is why I'm saying he was no longer in the cave or the outdoor stable in which he was born. He's now in a house, so it's sometime after the birth. "They saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshiped him." So interesting to me how their hearts and souls were prepared for this king to be a baby. And how they are exemplifying something that needs to be followed. The worship of this vulnerable baby. "Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh." Last year at our Christmas Eve service, we had frankincense sent. We're sending it around this room. And I have some, if you ever want to smell it. I have a couple kinds. I write in the program about this whole idea of these gifts. And this is a worthwhile effort to study these gifts and the import of these gifts. Because gold, we know, is a gift for a king. But frankincense and myrrh have so many qualities of healing or of medicinal qualities. And myrrh, especially, was used in embalming. And so it could well be that these are signifying Jesus' life. He's a king who's a healer who's going to die. Also, some people think, and it makes sense, they went from Bethlehem, not back to Nazareth. Where'd they go? Egypt. They didn't have a large cash reserve to go to Egypt. So these gifts could have been what they used to live in Egypt and to get through. We don't know, but that's quite plausible. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. Once again, a dream. Joseph had had a critical dream, and he's going to have another one to take the child and mother to Egypt. And now we have these guys with the dream. And you know what we hear today is happening in Babylon and in Persia and throughout the Muslim world is that many Muslims are having dreams about Jesus. I hear it all the time. And I've heard people who had those dreams, and that's a great encouragement to us. God is very much at work in that. Well, I want to look at four slides. What do the wise men fundamentally teach us that we need to take away from this story? All the interesting things, but there are some fundamental things we have to learn. First one is this, that Jesus, this baby they worshipped, is the King of the Jews, the Messiah. And as Gentiles, they worship him. Jesus is to be honored as the King of the Jews by Gentiles. Do you do that in your soul? Do you think of Jesus as your Savior? Yes. Your eternal Lord? Yes. Your friend? Yes. Judge of all the world? Yes. But he is the King of the Jews. He is their promised Messiah. These guys understood that. And for all of their strange beliefs, they understood that. I often wonder what happened to them after they left. Was there a conversion? Who knows? We'll see. This idea comes to me, and I think it's has great merit, and we should meditate on this, that in everything God does and has done, and we can look at Balaam and say that's a prime example, but there's so much more of time and place and what nature is doing and what other people who are just adjunct to the story are doing. But all of those things, it appears to me, God is superintending. He is making this story. So he has an overarching purpose in all things. And what is his purpose? And the book of John is so explicitly beautiful about this. His purpose is that Jesus be honored and worshiped. Honored and worshiped. So that even pagans would honor and worship him. Now that is a beautiful challenge to all of us, to honor and worship him. And friends, and I include myself in everything I'm saying, we can't do this sporadically and really do it well or really do it right. We should be very explicitly committed to a constant sense that whatever's happening in our world, if we're at school, if we're at work, if we're retired, if whatever, that what is happening in the world is all under the sovereignty of Jesus. Have that as our fundamental understanding, that all things are working together for good for those who love him. So I say here, all nature, tradition, and longing hearts led the Magi. There is something in this that they were willing to travel this far, to follow this star, to leave whatever life was, to go on this journey, because their hearts were drawing them. There was a transcendent sense in their hearts that they needed to be drawn. And they followed that. We've talked so much over the years about this whole German understanding that we don't have, this idea of Sehnsucht, that there's something in man that longs for joy and seeks joy. And I think these Magi exemplify that. When called to worship him, not all people do. Quite the opposite, they oppose him. So we've had all this discussion about how the sovereignty of God is over all the people and over all the efforts and all the nations, and that's all true. And does everyone receive it well? Herod was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. The power brokers didn't like Jesus. And when he appears in ministry, he was such a nightmare to the power brokers that they killed him. They didn't just send him away, they killed him. Oh, and by the way, so did we. Because what we learn in this understanding is that his death was ordained from before the time the world was created. And why was it ordained? Because every one of us was guilty. The finest person we know. It's so interesting. I've been reading a lot about Mother Teresa lately, and she was such a wonderful Christian sister. And reading about her, one of the finest people we know, and I said this last week, the finest people we know feel like they're more sinful than we probably do. Because the closer you get to God, the more you understand the difference between his perfection and our brokenness. Everyone needs Jesus, but not everyone accepts, receives, wants him. And that is in this story, isn't it? Herod wants to kill him and proceeds to kill all the baby boys in the region. And that's why they had to get out of there. What a brutal thing. What a horrible, horrible thing. Why? Because they can't worship and honor the King of the Jews. It's too threatening. I like this. They brought these gifts. And we're going to call them sacrificial gifts because they're very expensive gifts. Frankincense oil is not cheap. I can sell you some, but you don't want to buy it. It's not cheap. Josh can sell you some. He's got some. These are sacrificial gifts. These are not hay and stubble. And they presented those to the parents and to the baby. They sought him. They made the effort. They took this time out of their lives. And all of this had expense, but they did it, and it was right. And I think here's the point, that seeking him and sacrificial gifts to him are received by him with great joy. I've said this before, but you weren't all here to hear it. When my oldest daughter's family went back to Germany this year, it hit me like an explosion in my soul. It just knocked me for a loop. I remember the moment in Wheaton when we were saying goodbye and my soul just dove. And I should have known then that my antidepressants were not working anymore. but I didn't make that association. But my soul just dove. But you know what I know? Is that Jesus teaches us that you've never given up anything for the kingdom, but that he will restore it 100-fold in the kingdom of heaven. I have to tell myself that. There's something in your life. There's something in your life that you may have to sacrifice. He might be calling you to sacrifice this good thing for his kingdom, and it could hurt. It could be very painful. But in that sacrifice, you are connecting with God in a deep, deep way. And he's telling you, Jesus is telling you, that sacrifice is creating treasures in heaven. Treasures in heaven, treasures in heaven. This whole Magi thing is interesting. I don't know if they were converted or not, but it'd be pretty cool if they were, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be cool to talk to those guys? Let's hope we do. Okay, I need one of you guys. I was going to have Becky, but Tate's right there, or John. Go. Or, well, somebody tell them that we're ready for them, okay? All right. Thank you so much. Have a merry, merry Christmas. I'm so thrilled this year that for the first time in 11 years, I'm taking Sue to be a Norwegian on Christmas Eve. And it's a family dinner that they've done for decades. I mean, your whole life. Yeah, before that. So it'll be tasteless white food that we'll all enjoy very much. But thank you. Thank you for letting me do that. I haven't been able to do that since I was a pastor, so I'm looking forward to it. Okay? Okay, now the kids.